bit, then that would give them a seat on the aisle, and they wouldn't have to sit on the floor. There really are enough seats. There are enough seats in here. They just, if we put them in the middle of the aisle, people can't get to them. Okay, so last time we were talking about intellectual aspects of form. How do you look at form and you get messages from it? You get ideas, you get communication through the visual side of that form. And we looked at three different ways that plays itself out. And there, we could have looked at 15. There are many, many ways that architecture communicates through form. But we looked at the way that maybe the architecture gives a sense of order. And that may be saying for that culture or for that era, this is something important to us. We feel like human beings are in control, and they can create a kind of order and clarity. And that's what our lives are about. And so we can see in Greece, or we can see in the Renaissance, an attitude that's being embodied or communicated through the buildings of a whole era. But it also may be an individual building that actually it's clarifying and saying this is important for this function, this is important for this institution, to say something about stability, clarity, order. We looked at also the communication of complexity. Things that it says, you know, things are not that simple. Things are ambiguous. Things are nuanced. It's difficult. It's complicated. And there can be an expression of that sometimes in a whole era that says life is not about order and clarity and resolution. Things are unresolved and things are conflicting. Let's talk about it. And the building can express that kind of complexity. Or there also are times when a culture or maybe an individual function says, what's important to talk about here is technology. What's developing? What are we doing? What are we advancing? What is the latest thing? How can that be explained in this building? And we looked at something like Centre Pompidou. This, and really that was an introduction of a whole era of digital technology and obvious sort of engulfing our lives, even arts, with technology. And so you build this big, incredible art museum in the middle of the historic core of Paris, and you put all the technology out there where you see it. Every conduit, every plumbing chase, every air conditioning duct, every conveyance system. This is what the world is about. It's about technology. It's about all of these. And it almost looks like a circuit board or a, you know, it says something about a technology to come. That was in the 1970s, and there is something about our era that's expressed in that. And also something about a changing attitude toward art. Now, this is not grandma's art, a picture hanging on the wall. Art is all kinds of technological expressions, and art has gone that direction. And it was a museum for contemporary art. This was not for hanging traditional art. It was for about advanced art. And the building, through its technology and the expression of the technology, starts to say something about that. So I ask you in your Twitter card question, tell me buildings you can observe that might incorporate order or complexity or technique, and explain a little how it does that. Got some great answers. So for example, someone says, I think the UT Tower expresses order. Any of the four directions you look, you see the tower. It sticks up in the middle of the campus and looks down on everything, similar to Andre Palladio's Villa Rotunda. Absolutely. That is an expression of order. It orders the entire campus. The South Mall looks to the tower. The West Mall looks to the tower. The East Mall looks to the tower. It's at the center of the campus. It lets you know this is the heart, this is the soul of the campus. It becomes this powerful emblem of the whole university. It clarifies power for this institution by saying there is this hierarchical, clear, orderly organization of this campus. Someone else says the Eiffel Tower in Paris expresses the structural technologies that make up its structure. The methods of moving through it and up are hidden in the complexity of the structure. Again, really great example. This, in fact, designed by the great engineer Gustav Eiffel. It was an expression of steel technology. This is in the 19th century. But the Bessemer process had allowed them to produce steel. Steel was a super strong material, and it was built for a world's fair to demonstrate, well, look at what the hell we can do. We can build these tall buildings like this tower. Nothing had been done like that before. That's the precursor to skyscrapers. But it was saying, look at this technology we have, and look how that technology, by accumulating the loads and gracefully climbing to that height, it's an expression of what we can do now that other people couldn't do. Someone else says, the Perot Museum in Dallas, Texas, shows the technology in its architecture. It's a science museum, and the structure itself embodies new technology and forward-thinking architecture in its cubic and eco-friendly design. Absolutely true, and especially sort of at the base of that, a green roof on top of it, kind of analogy to landscape and geology and all of that kind of, and then this kind of like a geode kind of cracked at one point for the escalator to go up it. It is kind of a geological, natural form, and that's expressed in the character of the building. Someone else says, as a hockey fan, I've visited the American Airlines Center in Dallas many times. This is a building that embodies order. The passageways are ovals surrounding the ice rink, with food vendors placed symmetrically around all the floors. There are designated paths to follow depending on where your seat is, and thousands of people can have a comfortable experience. Yeah, pretty important in a place like that where strangers are all coming in trying to find their seat. Complicated thing, getting people getting them out. Yeah, if it's orderly, if there's some clear way that people move, it's logical, perfectly appropriate for something like an arena. Someone else says the state capital of Texas shows strict order, possessing general symmetry. In the inside, each side of the building resembles the other. It gives a sense of stability and order, which a government building is designed to do, to give an impression of stability of the government. Great point. Similarly, someone says the White House expresses order in a sense that there is great symmetry and balance from the exterior. This supports the idea that the White House is the backbone of our country and maintains the order in America. The order in the White House is symbolic of the order our government provides for us. And finally, someone says, my house that I grew up in reflects order by the geometrical and symmetrical order of the outside and the inside. The same number of windows are on each side of the front door. Each bedroom upstairs was the same size. The house used brick and had the living room as the central part of the house. So everything from houses to museums to public buildings to universities, they can possess this kind of communication. Same something about what feels comfortable for my family might be different from what feels comfortable for your family. We're expressing our own predilections in that selection of a house with order or with complexity, sometimes expressing advances in technology and in science through eco-friendly design, in the case of the Perot Museum, new structural possibilities, in the case of the Eiffel Tower. So all of that about how form can express meaning. Today, we're going to be discussing a little bit of a corollary of this, the notion of systems, especially kind of underlying systems of form in buildings and in cities. And today, we're going to up the scale a little bit, and just as in the last two lectures, we've looked sort of smaller scale at two-dimensional art. Now we're going to look at much, much larger scale and a whole city. And how do these issues we're talking about relate at that scale? I'm going to be talking today about a dictionary definition of architecture. And, you know, in the dictionary, maybe the first definition of architecture would have to do with buildings and design and that sort of thing, the normal parlance of that word. But about the sixth definition down in Webster's Collegiate Dictionary, it says that architecture is the underlying structure of anything. It defines the word architecture as the underlying structure of anything. And it gives an example of, let's say, the architecture of a political campaign. When we say the architecture of a political campaign, we're obviously not talking about buildings. We're talking about the underlying structure of that campaign. How did they conceptualize a direction or a flow or a organization of that campaign? What is the underlying structure of that campaign? You could talk about the architecture of a novel. How does it have a beginning and a middle and an end? How does it introduce its characters? What is the underlying structure of that novel? What is its architecture? Those of you in computer science, often, in fact, I think there are courses here talking about software architecture. Like the name of a course is software architecture. Now, that's not talking about buildings. That's talking about how do you define the kind of underlying structure of a software, of a computer program or of software. So there is a meaning of architecture that has to do with the underlying structure of anything. Now, why did that happen? Why are we using this word that it's about buildings. It has been for eons, but in the last decades, we've started to use the word architecture in a different way. And there's a good explanation for that. There is a characteristic of architecture making buildings, that is generalizable to many other fields. And that's germane for you taking a VAPA elective. What's germane about this to your field? So in this case, one thing that is very characteristic of architecture is that in the process of making it, you have to find a kind of underlying structure. You have to find a conceptual basis. We talked about earlier in the semester that any architecture problem is an indeterminate problem, an indeterminate equation. So there's not one answer to it. And we talked about that one way to address that indeterminacy is to bring to the problem some values. And if you take those values and you bring it to this indeterminate problem, then the next step would be to seek, well, what is a conceptual direction that would advance those values in the context of this problem? And what I'm really looking for is this underlying conceptual direction, this underlying structure that's going to inform the making of form beyond that. What you're looking for is, you can make an analogy to music. So in music, you might say, I'm going to use a rap format to develop this song. And rap format becomes an underlying structure for the design of that song. Or you could say, I'm going to use 4/4 time. And that's an underlying structure. I'm going to use in classical music a sonata form. These are underlying structures that then you build the design of that music around. And in architecture, it's very characteristic that we're constantly looking for that conceptual direction, that underlying structure in order to generate form. Now, ideally, it's something that comes out of values and out of the problem. It's not an arbitrary thing you just throw onto the design, but it's something that comes out of the situation that generates an underlying structure. But then that underlying structure has a life of its own, and it begins to be generative beyond that. So thinking of this underlying structure, let's think of how that's generalizable in other disciplines and why we start to think of other disciplines having an architecture to them. So I have an undergraduate degree. Besides my degree in architecture, I have one in business, and at the Sloan School at MIT. And it was very interesting in the particular era I was there. You could cross-register with Harvard, and you could take courses at Harvard Business School. So I took some courses at Harvard and some courses at MIT. And those two business schools had completely different approaches to how you solve a business problem. At Harvard, they were using what they called the case study method. And basically, that would mean that the way you learn to be a good business person is that you study how businesses have operated before, all of these case studies. You see how what worked and what didn't work. And you educate your intuition to then make good business judgments on your own. So if I see how marketing was done in this case, and how marketing was done in that case, and how marketing was done in that case, and then I'm given a marketing problem, I can find analogies and similarities, and I can educate my intuition to have the right urges in terms of solving that marketing problem. And that's one way of thinking, that it's intuitive. You're educating your intuition. And at the Harvard classes, that was the mode of operation. At MIT, there was this very influential guy named Jay Forster, who had kind of turned everybody on their head. And he thought that sometimes our intuition screws us up, and that you can use data, and you can use actually mathematical equations to model the performance of business, and that you should make business decisions based on that data and that modeling. Now, that modeling required that you understand the underlying structure of what's going on in a business. You have to understand in a deep way how it operates. And so you're trying to reduce it to very complex equations. I can remember one of the courses I took, we were modeling a dairy farm in New Hampshire. And we had to figure out, should this farmer, should he increase the size of his herd? Should he decrease the size of his herd? Should he expand the number of acres he has? Should he decrease the number of acres he has? And so you look at all kinds of things like, what is the price of milk? What is the projected future price of milk? What is the cost of grain and of feed? What is the cost of land? You take all of those forces and you begin to make these equations. And you're looking for the underlying structure that's actually making that system work. You're trying to model all of the forces and all of the elements that create a system by which economics work in the particular market of dairy farming. And it's a fascinating idea to seek that underlying system. Now, what was cool to me is I'm sitting there in architecture school, and that's exactly the way architects are taught to think, to look for that underlying structure in things. So that conceptual approach, like the Sloan School did, was much easier for me to understand than this much more kind of intuitive and less rigorous approach, it seemed to me, at Harvard Business School. And the truth is, over time, most business schools have gravitated toward modeling and looking at systems in business decisions. Now, in architecture, this has been built into the way we think for eons. One of the very most famous schools of architecture ever in the world was the École des Beaux-Arts in Paris. And in the 18th, 19th century, even well into the 20th century, this was the premier school of architecture in the world. And many, many, for instance, Paul Cray, who designed most of our campus in the 30s and 40s, came from the École des Beaux-Arts in Paris. And in the École des Beaux-Arts, they had a strategy for how you design something. So at the beginning of the semester, you'd be given a problem. This semester, we're going to be designing a library, a public library for a medium-sized city. And here's the site, and here's the program, and this is what we're designing. And what they would do is they would give you a week, and you would have a charrette, charrette, a charrette. That's a French word, and actually the charrette, a charrette literally in French means cart. And what would happen is that they would, everybody would work their tail off, just buzz themselves to death for a week, and they would try to find the conceptual core of how they were going to approach that problem. They called it an équise in French, or a scheme, or a concept. But in that 1 week, you were to try to find the underlying structure of this problem. What is the general organization and approach I'm going to take? And then you would document that, and you would make some drawings. And at the end of a week, at 4 o'clock on Friday or something, they would take a little cart through the studio, and everybody would have to put their drawings on the cart. And it didn't matter whether you were through or you weren't through, you put your drawings on the cart. And cart was charrette in French, so they called the whole process a charrette. And these became common words in architectural education everywhere. Charrette is this quick thinking through the larger problem and coming up with a scheme, a concept for it. And then in the Cours des Beaux-Arts, for the rest of the semester, the other 13 weeks or so, you then fleshed out that concept. But you had to stick with your concept. You couldn't rethink that again. It was so critical at the beginning to find the underlying concept for what you were going to do. Now, that is so embedded in architecture, that way of thinking, that we began to say, well, when a novelist has that kind of strong underlying structure, we're going to call it architecture. When a software program has that strong underlying structure, we're going to call it the architecture of that program. When a political campaign has that kind of strong underlying structure, we're going to call it the architecture of the political campaign. So this is so fundamental to the way we think about architecture. It's important to understand that's how we make form. So today we're thinking of how that is an inspiration for architectural form. Now, that takes many, there are many, many different underlying structures that one could use, or organizing devices. It's like a kind of filing system or something. So we're going to be looking at two primarily today, but there are many, many others that we could look at as well. So the primary one we're going to look at today is the grid as an underlying structure or an organizing system. And we're going to look at two examples at an urban scale. And the first we're going to look at is Austin, good old hometown, right here outside the door. So in 1836, Texas won its independence from Mexico in the Revolutionary War. And that made us the country of Texas, not the state of Texas, but the Republic of Texas. And at the beginning, the capital was in Washington on the Brazos. When Sam Houston became president, there were some entrepreneurs named Harris, who had a little town called Harrisburg down on the Gulf Coast. And they came to Sam Houston and they said, "Dude, we think you ought to move the capital to our fledgling little community here, do a little economic development, help them develop their land, make a little money here." But the carrot they offered him was, "If you'll move the capital here, we'll rename our town of Harrisburg and we'll call it Houston." So in fact, they renamed the town Houston and they moved the capital of Texas to Houston. Then after Sam Houston stopped being president, well, they thought, we don't really need to keep this little vanity action going here. And Houston was not deemed a good location for the capital. Number one, it was on the Gulf Coast, it was super humid, there were lots of mosquitoes. This was in a period when they were really worried about tropical diseases, and it was considered to have bad air in Houston. So it wasn't a healthy place to live. And then another thing was, this republic had just started, and it was still a little vulnerable. Their borders were not completely set. So they had all these Indians coming in from the west trying to threaten the settlers, and so it was kind of hard to keep the Indians at bay, and the Mexicans were still coming up from the south, and it was kind of hard to keep them at bay. And if your capital was way over here on one side of the country, that didn't establish your turf quite so strongly. So they thought, no, we need a capital that's more in the middle of Texas. So Mirabeau B. Lamar, the third president of the Republic, said, we got to move the capital and let's find a new site for this new capital city. So he sent a group of people up the Colorado River, which ran right through the middle of the state, and they located a piece of land that seemed to be ideal for this, and the decision was made to put the new capital on that location. And they chose that piece of land because of geographical reasons that had to do with the landscape in that area. And I think in order for you to see that slide, unfortunately, I'm going to have to turn the lights down. We're working on getting the lights not quite so dark, but I think for everybody else to see it, I'm going to have to do that. So in the slide on the right, you see what's called the Waller Plan for Austin. And it was done in 1839, right after they selected the city as the capital. And it was really based on how do we create an underlying structure for this new city to grow into. And the underlying structure had to do with several factors. For one thing, here's the river, the Colorado River right there. There was a long, slow rise going up from the river. It culminated in a hill right there, a very prominent hill, and that hill was where the Capitol building was meant to be. So as they looked from the river, they said, damn, this is the right spot. That's where the Capitol building is. It's going to look down on the river here. And there would be Congress Avenue, which would be this street that would connect the river and the hill. Then on either side, kind of symmetrically, there was a bluff over here, and there was a bluff over there, just about equidistant from that hill. And at the bottom of each bluff was a creek, what now is Shoal Creek over here, and Waller Creek over there. Shoal Creek over here, Waller Creek over there. So there was this kind of perfect symmetrical area that the city would be in, and it would be 14 blocks wide and 14 blocks long. So that's the original 14 block by 14 block Waller grid. Then within that, he placed four public squares: Republic Square, Wooldridge Square, Brush Square, and there was a fourth square that now is the Baptist Church. Don't even wonder how that happened, but somebody wrangled it for a church instead of for a public square. So the river was down here, Congress Avenue down the center, these four squares, 14 blocks by 14 blocks. Now, that was similar to but different from the way grids had been applied in Texas previously. So actually in the early part of the 19th century, when Thomas Jefferson made the Louisiana Purchase, he had the idea of putting a grid all over the Louisiana Purchase, basically taking all this land and creating an underlying structure for development. So there was a mile-by-mile grid that was superimposed over all that land. And all the division of the land and the selling of the land and the distribution of it was based on that grid. And that grid came all the way down, that original Jeffersonian grid, came all the way down into Texas, so that they had extended it down into Texas. And by the time this was happening, that grid was there. And there are a lot of Texas towns that were built on that due north, south, east, west grid that came from the Jeffersonian grid. And then in an immediate little town, they usually would have all these squares in the grid. In the middle would be a square where they put the county courthouse, and then they would put the commercial buildings around that, and that would be the courthouse square, and then it would be residences around that. So that's a very clear underlying structure for those little towns, and you probably have experienced that in some of the small towns in Texas. So that's true of Lockhart, it's true of Giddings, it's true of Waxahachie, it's true of Hillsboro. Madisonville. There are probably two dozen of these little classic towns. Anybody from a town that has a courthouse in the center and the grid around it? Yeah, a couple. That's good. So that generally was applied where it was flat ground. And there were no particular features to alter that generic grid. In this case, because it's the capital of Texas, and there needs to be this capital building, because there was this hill there, because there were bluffs on either side, because there were the creeks there, it altered that generic grid, and it made one where the square is not in the center, it's up where the hill is, where there is this strong axis connecting the river and the hill, and where the grid sits in that valley that's created by nature. Now, in addition to that, they named all the north-south streets for the rivers of Texas. And they go from east to west across the city as they go east to west across the state. So the easternmost street, actually the easternmost one was called East Avenue. And then it was Sabine, which is the river that is the border with Louisiana, the easternmost river. So it was Sabine and then Trinity and then San Jacinto and then Brazos. And then there was Congress Avenue in the middle. And then still proceeding east to west with the rivers after Brazos, then on the other side of Congress is Colorado, then Lavaca, then Guadalupe, then San Antonio, then Nueces, and then Rio Grande. Rio Grande being the westernmost river in Texas, right on the border with New Mexico and running through El Paso. So again, based in geography. So they're making this underlying structure of the city reinforce again a notion of geography. And then the east-west streets were all named for the trees of Texas. So there were live oak and peach and bodark and cypress and all these trees of Texas, and they were the east-west streets. Pecan, for example, was what now is 6th Street. Later on, they changed them to numbers, but originally they were based in geography as well. So what the underlying structure was responding to was the geography of the site, the geography of the state, the geography, the plants, the rivers, the landscape of the place. And that was very much inspiring an underlying structure for the city. And then after that concept or scheme or a keys for the city was developed, then subsequent design decisions begin to flesh out how the city is put together. So this is a drawing that was done in the 1850s. It shows the old Capitol building, the original Capitol building, built on that hill. It was a little warty thing that did not have the right scale, so it just looked like a little pinprick up there. Not a good gesture. Luckily, it burned down in the 1880s, and they built a big-ass, big, strong Capitol building that could kind of stand in the landscape at the appropriate scale. Then from that hill, then Congress Avenue came down here, and that's Congress Avenue right there. And naturally, it began to get the commercial structures on it. It's the most ceremonial street. It's the central street. It makes the connection to the river. So it began to get the commercial buildings on it. So you had the Capitol building and the commercial buildings coming down here, and then just the houses and farms immediately beyond that in the 1850s. So the underlying structure is telling everybody what to do next. Where do you put your commercial building? The underlying structure told you Congress Avenue is the place. Then actually in the other direction, you began to get 6th Street right here. And the road came into 6th Street and went out from 6th Street. So it came from Bastrop and went out to Marble Falls. And that also began to collect some commercial buildings along it. So Congress Avenue and 6th Street in the grid of the city had the natural role as more the commercial streets. And then the residential streets were around that. This is a drawing that was done in the 1880s. Now we got our big-ass Capitol building holding its own against that hill right there. Congress Avenue starting down that direction. There you can see Congress Avenue with its now significantly developed commercial character to it. By now, the second hill up has become the university, and that's the old main building of the university that was built on that second hill up. Again, geography continuing to tell people this is where the underlying structure places things. It's determined by geography. There you see Congress Avenue going into the Congress Avenue Bridge right there. Here we can see one of those squares, that's Brush Square. That's where they put the marketplace. If you've got an open square here, then when we have Saturday and all the farmers come in from outside, that's a great place for the market to be. So that located there because of the underlying structure where that square was. 6th Street you can see developing through there as that cross street that goes on out. The edge of the city at the bluff right there, eventually, that became I-35. How did they know where to put I-35? It was at that edge that had originally been determined as the stopping point of the city. So that interruption became then the location in the 1950s for I-35 as it came through. There's that bluff to the west up above Lamar. Here you can see above the old grid, the university on that hill. Beyond, you can see Hyde Park, that neighborhood developing as a different grid up there. All of these underlying structures having fundamental impact on where what building is, where what kind of development occurs, all of them based in geography. Now, as the city grew, we had that original grid of downtown. We had a different grid for the UT campus that really had to do with the relationship between those two hills, where the Capitol building was and where the old main was and the axis that went that way. A different grid up here for Hyde Park, which was a residential neighborhood and had its own determinants for an underlying structure. And that's really how the city of Austin has grown. Okay, so that's this notion of underlying structure. Let's think of the grid in another application, just to let you see there are other ways to conceptualize the way a city might develop. This is the city of Savannah in Georgia. It was developed in the early part of the 18th century, earlier than Austin, and it was developed by James Oglethorpe. Now, Savannah is a kind of interesting historical case. What happened was in England, if people were poor and they couldn't pay their debts, they were thrown into jail. Well, of course, if you get thrown into jail, you'll never be able to pay your debts because you can't work and you can't make any money and you can't ever pay your debts. So it was a stupid system. But they had all these people hadn't paid their debts. They get thrown into jail. The jails are full of people. They're actually pretty good people. They just ran on hard times. And so James Oglethorpe comes up with this idea. We got this new colony over in America. And how about if I take a whole bunch of people from the jails and I take them over to Georgia and I start a new penal colony in a certain way? I mean, these people are in jail. They don't have any choice. It's not like they wanted to come. No, you can either stay in jail in England or you can go over to this penal colony over in America. But he wanted to take them and give them all a fresh start. And then if they could make some money and they could pay their debts, they're off the hook. So it's a much better system. So he's building a city to accommodate these people who honestly hadn't made things work very well in their lives. Their lives were screwed up. So he had an idea of, if I build a city that has a very strong sense of community and everyone helping each other, and where it's not dog-eat-dog and somebody's trying to screw you, but everybody's trying to work together to help everybody do well, then everybody's going to do okay. And it'll be a farming community, and you know, but everybody will have a chance to have their farm and raise some money and pay their debts and be off the hook and be an independent citizen. So the generating thing for this city is this sense of community, making a place where there's a good neighborly support system. So the site is actually no geography, very, very neutral. Flat land was covered with trees. They ripped out all the trees, and they built this city in a very generic geography. So it's not geography that's creating the underlying structure. That's not the conceptual basis. In this case, the conceptual basis is that notion of creating a community. So he starts the community with these little wards. So this would be four wards. One, two, three, four. Each ward had a little park in the center of it. And that was to be the central focus of that community. So there'd be maybe 200 people that would live in a ward. And there are four of them to start. And then as it grows over time, there's six of them. And then there are eight of them. And that's how the city would grow, by these little micro communities. But there would always be a micro community. No matter how big the city got, there still would be these little micro communities. And that's the design of one of these wards, with a little square in the center of it. And then there would be these more prestigious parcels right there on the square. They would be maybe a church, maybe a school. Maybe as somebody got a little more wealth or prominence, they might be able to afford a house on one of those. But those were kind of the more prominent parcels on the square. And then there were very everyday parcels for the common man. And everybody's sort of egalitarian there. And they would be in these parcels on either side. But everybody would have a sense of their neighborhood and their community collecting around that. And then the city would be this collection of all of these wards together. It's a very clever system where in between wards, there would be streets that would be the, you know, streets you'd go from one neighborhood to another, and they'd be straight and easy to pass. And then there would be these streets that went around the squares. So that street, there would be more pedestrian streets. And you'd, as you walk through the city, you would get green space, green space, green space, green space, green space. And you'd be able to interact with all these little micro communities through the city. So it was social goals that he had for how you create the underlying structure of the city. And Savannah has had this beautiful neighborly quality to it through its whole history. On the left, we have one of those squares with two churches, in this case, that are on the square there. And then there are other areas where it's just ordinary neighborly houses, and that's in each little micro community has a lot of real estate just for ordinary people to have very, very accommodating but not fancy houses. And then occasionally there might be, you know, somebody accumulates a little wealth and they can have a more prestigious house on one of these more prestigious parcels on the square. So there's the ability for aspiration, there's the ability for a strong sense of neighborliness and community. And in fact, that worked very well in Savannah. So, two different instances at an urban scale of creating an underlying structure. And then over the centuries in both Austin and Savannah, those underlying structures have generated where what things go and how the city is built. And it then starts to have a life of its own, generating form for the city. Now, let's take that same underlying structure notion and apply it now to individual buildings. So this is the Central Bay Here office building in Apeldoorn, about 60 miles east of Amsterdam in Holland. This was a case where a very large insurance company decided they were going to move out of Amsterdam into this relatively small city. But it's a huge company, so it's like 1,000 people work in this building. And in some ways you could think of it, that's enough people and it's complicated enough. It's like a kind of mini city. And the architect, Hermann Hertzberger, thought of it kind of as a little city. And just like a city has a commercial district and a residential district, and it has office spaces and has industrial spaces and all those things that have to be organized. So this big complex building would have some worker spaces, some, there have to be restaurants, cafes, people have to have their lunch. There have to be conference areas for not only meetings within the group, but outsiders coming in and having meetings there. There have to be parking areas, there have, you know, recreational areas for the employees because they're not in an urban area. All of those things have to be organized. So he's thinking, how do I get an underlying structure that will tie all of those things together? And like the two cities we've just looked at, he uses a grid. And in this case, it's a grid that we call a tartan grid. So there is a wider piece and then a narrower piece and wider and narrower and wider and narrower. So there's a wide square and then there's a narrow space and a wide square and a narrow space. And it creates this tartan grid through the whole thing. In general, the wider spaces become occupied office kinds of spaces. The smaller spaces become the passageways and the circulation through the building. And then that grid is altered somewhat. You can see a kind of indentation there and there and there and there. Those are the entry points to the building. And they connect. This one goes from a parking area here into the building and onto the kind of square of the old part of Appledorn. And this one goes from another kind of office complex area over to the train station over here. So these are desire lines that went through the site, and they begin to alter the grid so that it indents at those points like that. So the underlying structure is reacting to the need sometimes for private worker spaces and sometimes for circulation, the need for connections to these various things outside the site and in the town. And he's making this tartan grid respond to conditions there. But then it begins to take a life of its own as well. So we see each of those little pods becoming a little community of office workers. And then we see these interstitial spaces that become the passageways through there. Those interstitial spaces are very important for bringing light into the building from above. And then the edges of those pods, sometimes they can be completely open like that and get lots of light. Sometimes they can have like blinds on them that alter the light. Sometimes they can have glass block that gives you privacy but still a little bit of borrowed light. So there's many different variations of how you can deal with the edges within that tartan grid. And then it begins to tell you where the functions are. So in that area right here, where that desire line and that desire line meet, you have a kind of town square that occurs right there. And around that town square, that's where you get the cafes and the eating places. So, you know, maybe your kids could come in the summertime at lunch and have lunch with mom or dad in this little town square in the middle of the building, and then they go home and mom and dad go back to their work in their more private cubicle or pod. The conference areas are also kind of arranged around that central core. That's where all the escalators are and the major circulation through the building. So again, just like in the city, certain functions fall out in certain places because the underlying structure advises that. The underlying structure also tells you what the actual structural system is. Each of those little squares has an X-shaped structure there that actually supports the building. And so the grid determines a concrete structural system as well. It also tells you where all the mechanical systems go. So they distribute through the building. The heating and air conditioning ducts all go in those interstitial spaces, just like in a city. All the plumbing and the sewer lines and the electrical service, they all go through the streets or the interstitial spaces between the blocks, and they distribute them evenly and efficiently through the building. And so it begins to tell you where functions go. It introduces light and the variability of light. It tells you where the structural system is. It tells you where the mechanical systems go. But it's all dependent on that initial concept, a key scheme of what is the underlying structure we're going to use to design this building. Okay, so we've been kind of reveling in grids here. Let's open it up a little bit and think of some other underlying structures. So honestly, you could have many different underlying structures. These days, often high schools are arranged on very diagrammatic underlying structures. You might have a high school that has the gymnasium and the cafeteria as two anchors. And then you have kind of a mall in between of all the classrooms and the passageway that connects those two anchors. Or maybe you have one with three anchors, and it's sort of the theater and the cafeteria and the gymnasium. And there's kind of T-shaped circulation, and the classrooms are along there. Or maybe it's a high school with the math and science and STEM classes are all in this area, and there's a pod for them. And English and history are all in this area, and there's a pod for them. And then athletics and arts are in this area, and there's a pod for them. And then those three pods are connected by a courtyard. These are all underlying structures for how to organize all the pieces together. In this case, we're looking at an underlying structure that we might call tubes of space. And this was in these drawings that's being explored by Le Corbusier. We looked at Ronchamp, the little chapel by Le Corbusier, earlier in a lecture. And in Rasmussen's book, he's very fond of Le Corbusier, so he shows you Unité d'Habitation by Le Corbusier, Housing at Pessac by Le Corbusier, Chapel at Ronchamp by Le Corbusier. So this is an architect we'll look at repeatedly through the semester. But in this case, in the 1930s, Le Corbusier got interested in this system of spaces that he observed in the southern part of France. He had he lived in Paris, but he had a second home in the southern part of France. And in the southern part of France, it's a big wine country. And so they have all these caves. And these caves were places where in ancient times they would store the wine because it was cool in the cave. And then as they ran out of cave space, they began to make these cave spaces or things like a cave where they had walls on either side and then they had a vault over them, but a kind of tube-like, cave-like space where they stored the wine. And so Le Corbusier could go to southern France and observe these series of walls parallel to each other with vaults that connected across them. And he was fascinated by that as a system, as a potential ordering system for buildings. So in the 1930s, he's exploring that in this sketch and in that drawing as a way of making housing. So these would be like row houses, and each person's house would be two of these little vaulted spaces, and they would be long and thin, and they would have the living room and dining room facing one direction and getting light, and then they would have two bedrooms, one under each of the vault facing the other direction. So you got a nice little two-bedroom house that would be accumulated into this little village. And he's just exploring that. He also explored it in a project he was doing for cooperative farming villages. And he was fascinated by seeing those forms in silos, as if those caves and vaulted forms were turned on their end. And so he saw the silos and he thought, well, could you make the buildings for the farms in these vaulted shapes, kind of like the silos tumped over, and sometimes in tall buildings, sometimes in short buildings. He was fascinated with the idea of maybe they aren't walls on either side, maybe they're series of columns. So you could just have these very light structures with the vaults on top of them. And explored this as a system of form with a lot of different potential applications in the 1930s. But he never had a commission that seemed like this was the right underlying structure to apply to that. He just was exploring it as a potential. Now, there's a lesson to be learned there. It's not like you just come up with some cool-ass system and just arbitrarily apply it. No. You got to wait for the moment where the circumstances and the intentions all make that underlying structure appropriate for what you're doing. So he sits on this for 20 years, doesn't do any buildings that have this underlying structure at all. But then he gets a commission to do a house in India. And this is a house for a very large extended family. It's the Sarabhai family. And so there would have been the parents. Well, there probably originally would have been the grandparents and the parents and the sons and all the kids that the sons had. So this is the way Indian families worked in this generation, still do to a large extent, these extended family homes. So that's what he's making, is a house for this extended Sarabhai family. And the site that he was given was a gated community. So there's a whole district of the city that is kind of walled off from the rest of the city. And they have security guards, and all the rich fat cats in Ahmedabad live in this little gated district. So you don't have the hoi polloi and thieves and beggars and all that around. So now you've got a little district that's protected. And it meant that they don't really have any security issues there. You don't have to lock your doors or anything because there's a wall around it and there are security guards that protect this little district. And in that district, there are beautiful big trees and lush landscape, and it's really, really gorgeous in there. So Le Corbusier says, you know, what I want to do here is I want indoors and outdoors to be connected. I want you always to feel like you're part of these gardens. So this tube of space was a wonderful way of saying, anytime I'm in a room, it's shooting my eye right out to the landscape, constantly connecting me to the landscape everywhere. And also, he needed a very flexible system because sometimes you need big spaces for large gatherings of this extended family. Sometimes you need tiny spaces for kitchens and bathrooms and small bedrooms. So I need something that can be both really big and really intimate all at the same time and still have a cohesion to it. So he says, look, this system that I've been looking at with the tubes of space, it's going to work well. It means that when I have a living room, I can see right straight through to the landscape in this direction, in that direction, right straight through to the landscape, you know, works perfectly that way. It also can accommodate everything from a carport for the car to, in this case, one of the sons who doesn't have any kids, a little living room and bedroom and kitchen and a little place for the servant there and a bathroom, and it accommodates that. But it also can accommodate much bigger spaces. This is in more the extended families area where there's a big open living room, a big open dining room. So by altering how much wall or how much columns or how much piers there are in those supports, then with the vault going over, it can create a wide range of openness or closure and accommodate these needs of that extended family. So after 20 years of not using this system, he says, this is the spot. This is the time. It works well with this site and with this program for that house. So here we are inside the Sarabhai house. You have these walls, and sometimes they're brick, and sometimes they're plaster, and sometimes they're long and continuous, and sometimes they're broken into columns, and they support a beam that then supports the vault, and everywhere you get the intimacy of this vault, like a real womb-like, small-scaled room, but then you can open it up and actually have a large floor area for a larger living room for the family. So always that extension, looking out to the garden, everywhere, always out to the garden. Beautiful house. Oh my God, this is, I can remember when I first saw this house, I thought, this is the best house I've ever seen in my entire life. It's warm and it's rich and it's not fancy and pristine. I mean, these people live in it like a home, you know, they got all their shit and some of it's really great, and it's really valuable, and some of it just means something to them. It was grandma's, and so it's here. And so it's not this prissy house, but it's very lived in, very comfortable. And then always this connection to the garden. And they don't even have, doors. That's a pivot door. Some of these just have kind of rolling screens that come down. but because they don't have to worry about it from a security point of view, they just live indoors and outdoors. There's a swimming pool. There's a slide down from the upper kids' bedrooms right smack into the swimming pool. You just go out of the bedroom onto your balcony, whoosh, right into the swimming pool. It's really integrated into the landscape, and it's this tubes of space notion that allows that to happen. So, beautiful match of a system, an order, an underlying structure, and then generating a house around that. Similar use of these tubes of space in the Kimball Museum in Fort Worth. How many people have been to the Kimball Museum? Okay, a few. I got to tell everybody, if you don't go to see this building sometime in your life, you're an idiot. This is the best building in Texas. All right, I'm going to just put a stake in the ground there. It's the best building in Texas. It's a magnificent, magnificent piece of architecture by a really good architect, Lou Kahn, who we talked about. So the Bryn Mawr dorm last time. We'll see other buildings by Lou Kahn. So in this case, he's got this museum he's doing. It's got a restriction on height, so it's going to be this low, flat museum. He looks around in Fort Worth. There are all these grain elevators, because that's Fort Worth. It was a big grain town. And actually, Kimball, the guy who gave all his money to the museum, he made his money in flour, which was grain, which was those grain elevators. So, and in fact, on this site, right on Axis, there was a big grain elevator that was right there. It's been torn down since then. But he thought of the grain elevators and that as a generative element. But also he's thinking about the program and the structure. He's thinking about a lot of different things. But this as an underlying structure seems to do all those things together. So you see the building is made out of this unit that is a vault. And in this case, the vault sits on four columns. And it makes these series of long, thin spaces like that. And they collect to make the museum around a little entry courtyard there. That's the front porch of it that shows those two front wings and the courtyard in between. The back is sliced off a little bit more abruptly. And then as you come into the museum on the front, there is that system that's introduced to you. There is a vault held up by columns at the four corners. There is no doubt that, I mean, actually, Lou Kahn had visited the Villa Sotheby, that one we just saw, shortly before he designed this building. He was doing a building in Ahmedabad as well. And Lou Kahn didn't get to be a really great architect till he was like in his 50s. And somebody asked him one time, what were you doing in all that time before your 50s when you suddenly got to be this really good architect? And he says, I lived in a city called Le Corbusier. So basically he said, I just was looking at this guy Le Corbusier and I was studying his work and I was understanding what he was doing. So clearly, he looked at those things that Le Corbusier was exploring in the 1930s and this tubes of space notion. And he saw the drawings with the columns instead of the walls. And so he creates a variation on that for the Kimball Museum. And it does so many things beautifully, but it is this underlying structure that gives birth to all of these smaller decisions. So inside, this is the kind of paintings they had. Smaller paintings. This is not a modern art museum. This is traditional art. And the paintings are meant to be hung on the wall. And so they're room-like spaces created by that vault that are very intimate, very personal, and they fit the scale of these paintings, which were in homes. They fit that very nicely. But at the same time, this is a big art museum, and they have to have changing exhibitions, and they have to open it up and have circulation of lots of people. So this allows for that room-like scale, but also big open spaces where you can have flexibility to have a lot of different kinds of exhibitions. Also takes care of all the, art museums have to have these very precise mechanical systems. And just almost the opposite of what the Centre Pompidou was doing. In this case, he takes all those mechanical systems and services and puts them in these interstitial spaces. So a vault and an interstitial space and a vault, and all of the services go in that space. All the stairways in the building, all the heating and air conditioning, all the plumbing, all the electrical, everything is served so that the vaults can be pure. They don't have to have a hung ceiling. They don't have to have chases. They're just pure open spaces. And then a third thing accommodated here is the light. Very important in an art museum. You want to have natural light, but you want to be protected from ultraviolet rays. So he puts a long, thin skylight at the top of that vault, introduces a little dose of that bright Texas sun, and then modifies it with this stainless steel screen that's perforated. So a little bit of that light creeps in, but a lot of that light gets bounced back onto the vault, and the vault then reflects the light, this soft, natural light into the room. So it's a device for structure. It's a device for lighting. It's a device for allocating where the mechanical systems and all the services of the building will go. And it does that in a very natural, simple, poetic way. It's not heavy-handed, and it is the system that really is letting you know how to deal with the light, how to deal with the mechanical systems, and how to deal with the structure, and how to create the intimacy of all of those spaces. And then occasionally there's a courtyard that is hollowed out within that system, and that creates another kind of experience and a different kind of light. Or sometimes there's an auditorium, a completely different kind of function, and one vault and one interstitial space is the right dimension to make this auditorium that has a long focus to a stage at one end. In one of those vaults, they actually have a floor halfway up, and there's a little library that's tucked up there, and you're right up intimate against the vault. So right next to the Kimball Museum is this newer museum, the Fort Worth Modern Museum. It was done much later in 2002 by Tadao Ando, just as Lou Kahn learned a lot from Le Corbusier and admired him immensely. So Tadao Ando learned a lot from Lou Kahn and admired him immensely. And he creates a different kind of tubes of space in the Fort Worth Modern Museum. Again, these series of, in this case, wide, thin, wide, thin, wide, thin galleries. And then you move across that and it gives some variation as you move through. That system gives you the structural system for the building. It gives you where mechanical spaces go in the building. It gives you light distribution for the building, very much in the same way, but with a different geometry than was present in the Kimball Museum. And again, then it gives that variation. In this case, you move through those series of linear spaces, and it gives you a lot of variety. Often the problem of museums is museum fatigue. But in this case, you're constantly getting that rhythm of moving back and forth through those linear spaces, and it very much is the inspiration for the geometry of the whole building. So the point here is that if you're creating form in architecture, one of the fundamental things is this notion of an underlying structure and seeking a kind of conceptual or systemic way to inject that into the building that responds to the needs of that site or that program. At the scale of the city, at the scale of a museum, at the scale of a house. So the Twitter card question for today is to ask you, and this one's it's a little bit hard. I'm not saying this is easy. I want you to think really hard and think of a building you might have experienced that has an underlying structure. I want you to do detective work here and deconstruct the building and figure out what is the underlying structure of that building or of that campus or of that city, of my town that I grew up in or of my suburb where my house was located or my high school or my elementary school, or some place I visited. But think of some place that has an understandable underlying structure. Is it a grid? Is it a radial pattern? Is it a series of courtyards linked by malls? You know, what is the underlying structure of that place that you can identify and is kind of the source of where the form is created in that building?